witching hour. Why do we wake each night in that spiritless moment between worlds, we mothers, daughters, and wives? And why does the night abandon us to twinkling worry, to the rattling breaths of our children, to the hard floor of our long prayers? And what fresh dangers tap against the black window? Why do our men snore so easily when the horror gathers? And why is it always at 3:15 that evil drags us from beneath the red wine or the white pills to make us sit up and see the world so clearly? Who comes to whisper our names and turn our blood to sludge? Where is the mercy for those of us who lie awake, weeping in the eternal hours before the crucifixion?
What keeps you awake, Desiree?
Well, I think I'm a lot like a lot of women, and it's worry. It's worry about all the woulds, shoulds, coulds, mights. I think quite often women feel like the cruise directors for so many other lives, that it's just so hard to pack it all into a 24-hour period of time and to feel like you've been everything you needed to be for everyone that needed you.
No, I think you're right. We women, for some reason, tend to do that most of all. Cruise directors, I like that. So give us a little background, Desiree. I've looked at a little bit at your bio, and it's very rich. You've got 2 Pulitzer Prize nominations. That right there will stop you in your tracks. You're a columnist and still probably are an activist in Detroit, former attorney, Kresge fellow, and it goes on. Give us your version of your background and what you're doing today.
Zenta, thank you for not calling me schizophrenic, which is a bit what my resume looks like. Let me just start by saying I have never not wanted to write. Mm. I mean, I just remember my first thoughts about about picking up a crayon, about picking up books. Mm. It's always been about storytelling for me. I'm a military brat. My dad was in the Air Force, and I spent 9 of my first 14 years of traveling in Japan. I was actually born in Japan. And that proved to be just a profound, rich experience for me. Some people talk a lot about how hard it must be to move and keep moving. For me, there was a lesson there that friends are waiting wherever you go. Your life is wherever you go. It's not like life isn't going to happen.
That's a wonderful perspective.
Well, it bore out for me. It's not a Pollyanna. It bore out for me. I haven't found a place where I couldn't call home or make home in some way or the other. Mm-hmm. And I think that it also enriched my sense about a commonality of the human experience. Like, it wasn't just a regional experience or just a cultural experience or just a gender experience, but as I uprooted and moved to very different places, I found very similar ways to connect with people. So that's what has kind of fueled my love affair with stories, because that's what they do. Grow up and get a job, you know how people tell you that? It's like, your poems are real cute, but grow up and get a job. And so I ended up in journalism and in practicing law. And a lot of that was around what am I going to do for a living? But ultimately, journalism was another way to tell those stories, and I just felt so blessed to be able to get up every day as a columnist and be able to walk into other people's lives and to be able to translate that into story for others to understand. So that's what I'm still doing in some way, shape, or form, and once I figured out that I was a storyteller, it kind of made all those weird jumps and leaps in my career make some kind of sense.
So these 2 Pulitzer Prize nominations, what were the stories you were working on for that?
Both nominations were for a story that I was covering over the long term. There was a boy in Pontiac, Michigan named Nathaniel Abraham, who at 11 years old became one of the first youngest people in the United States to be charged as an adult for murder. Mm. And I covered his case for about 2.5 years, delving into his family, the circumstances, the trial, the victim's family, and once again sort of telling stories from all sides as the case emerged. He was eventually sentenced as a juvenile and not as an adult.
Oh, good.
And he was released at age 18 and eventually reoffended and went to prison as an adult on a drug offense.
Mm, that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
So as a journalist, how was it to switch over to creative fiction? Not all journalists can do that. It's a very different type of writing. What were the challenges, the differences for you? And you also write poetry, right?
Right. Well, the good thing for me is that I was always a columnist as a journalist. Mm. So one thing I never had to put away was my voice. In fact, I was paid to have a voice, which is a really sweet spot for someone who wants to be a creative writer and a journalist at the same time. I think for me, journalism really trained me to be able to compress stories so that, as it turned out, so two things. One thing is I studied poetry as a way to take long stories and bring them tightly into a small space, the column space. And so there were many times when I would write a column as a poem and then from that expand it into the column. I could spend a day or two with someone and I only had like between 500 and 700 words, which is like two or three double spaced pages to compress all that time and all that insight I got from being with someone. So it was daunting. And I found that efficiency of language, studying language, compressing language the way you have to fit a column space or to write a poem were very, very instructive for me. In my mind, though, I always wanted to write a novel. You know, I've always wanted to do that, to have a novel. And so when I started turning to more professionally to my creative writing, I started on the novels and I couldn't carry the narrative. And I realized that years of compressing had developed a muscle. And the reason I wasn't succeeding as a novelist is because I know how to write short. And thank God I stumbled upon flash fiction, which has been around forever, but is really gaining a lot of popularity with people using more mobile devices.
And our short attention spans, eh?
And short attention span, or short time, you know?
Yeah.
You don't have a lot of time. So flash fiction became, like, what could be more natural? I mean, people look at me a little bit and say, how can you put so much into a short amount of space? I'm like, well, why do you need more space? You know, I've only been doing this my whole life, is telling stories in short spaces.
And you're very good at it. In this collection of 30 vignettes, we're talking about Know the Mother. Just like Witching Hour, that was the whole thing that you read. That wasn't just an excerpt. That was the entire story. And this is just a wonderful collection of these short pieces that just grab you by the throat and don't let go.
Well, I do think Witching Hour is one. There are a few pieces there that really make you wonder, is she really writing poetry or is this prose? I think it really does walk the line.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think Witching Hour is one of the ones that has a little less sort of plot. It's more about an instant. It's about that time where so many, and I know this is more common among women, wake up and it's always that same time. You look at the clock, it's exactly the same time, and it's always around 3 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And what is that about? You know, and through time, people have started calling that the witching hour for real. And it's supposedly the 12 hours before the crucifixion of Jesus.
Oh, interesting.
That is sort of how that time has been memorialized in some religious thought or superstitious thought. I'm not quite sure where it comes from. And so I was just thinking about that, like how often women wake up at that exact hour and they are, as perhaps the mother of the Christ may have been, worried about their children, worried about their child, worried about what's going on, saying those quiet prayers, feeling that dread or anticipation while the world is asleep.
And a lot of this collection is about the role of mother, obviously from the title too. And that a mother can have many other roles in her life, too. And you address topics of sexism and racism. Talk about that.
You know, it's so interesting. As an African-American writer, there's always been a bit of a litmus test about, is your writing black or is it female?
Mm.
Which is a little ridiculous as far as I'm concerned, because that's how I walk through the world. So everything I write is both. And yet there's something very interesting about gender to me. Part of me feels that even if racism were to disappear tomorrow, gender would still be there staring us in the face. That within the smaller microcosms, for example, in my own nuclear family, racism doesn't rear its ugly head except for as it's part of institutions that we move around in or a part of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't remember a spouse or a child saying anything racist to me ever. But I can't say that about gender. As a black woman, married to a black man and giving birth to black children, gender, I have been the victim of sexism in my house. I mean, people think I know where their socks are because I have ovaries.
Right.
Or people think I ought to be there for them 24/7 because of my gender.
Mm-hmm.
Or with my parents, I didn't take my husband's last name when I got married. And my mother would write me cards forever to Mrs. Desiree blank blank, you know,
mm-hmm.
not accepting that I had the exact same name that she gave me when I got, you know, when I was born. So the gender stuff I find is so, so powerful. And it goes into very, very, very deep into every relationship. Where race, I do think sometimes has a way of standing back with mm-hmm. with particular relationships. And so Know the Mother does explore that. Not every story has a racial aspect, but I do think that every story does ask the question about gender and gender roles.
Are you raising sons, daughters?
Both, and I'm sighing about it. There's nothing we can do about this. I really, as a feminist, my daughter once said to me, she was probably about 4, and she said she didn't want to go swimming because she didn't want to mess up her hair. And I'm like, what? Like, never, ever put adventure before beauty. Are you nuts? You know?
Yeah.
And she is like the most traditional. She doesn't really rail against these roles the way I have done my whole life. And maybe it's because I have done that, that she feels more comfortable. Like, the battle's happening elsewhere. I don't need to fight that. My son, I think, has a level of consciousness, I would hope, about it, that maybe people that don't have quite as strident feminist of a mother has. And he's married to a very, very accomplished woman, and he seems to be satisfied with that. But, you know, he will put those pants on the floor and wait for someone to tell him to pick them up like they're not his. So I don't know what to do about it all.
I've got a son and a daughter, and I can identify with what you're saying. I bought both of them dolls. I bought both of them cars and blocks and building toys when they were young. But I would see them each go the more typical way. But exactly what you're saying. I think my son has grown up more aware of the strength of women with more respect. And, you know, and on both genders, I think it's worked that way. So maybe that's what the goal should be. That and abolishing pink and blue for children.
Right.
That drives me crazy.
Exactly. I totally agree with that. You know, and I think another thing that's been so interesting that actually didn't show up, and this is a good idea for another story, so thanks for this conversation, but I'm thinking about the role that sports has played in gender roles since I was a girl, and we played the girl sports, and, you know, nobody came to see our games and that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was before Title X. I'm 55, so that was before Title X.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm seeing girls now who have never not been physically active in team sports or individual sports. And I think that boys have grown, you know, respecting girls as athletes. And somehow that is, you know, to take the metaphor all the way, leveled the playing field a little bit and has allowed interaction on a level that was solely the purview of boys. You know, I don't mean to minimize academia and all other kinds of ways that women are competing, but I think on some level that sports has really kind of taken things up a notch for an entire generation.
And this collection also, the cover, it's got a very evocative cover, a white woman's hands over a black woman's eyes. And yet it seems to be all in play. She's smiling. What was the decision-making behind the cover?
Well, Zinta, what you don't know is that the back cover is exactly the reverse. It is a white woman with a black woman's hands covering her eyes.
Now, see, the review copy does do that.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a surprise.
Okay.
The name of the art is called Guess Who, and it's by a South African woman named Karin Miller. It's K-A-R-I-N Miller. And I was looking around for artwork that I thought could be representative of what I was trying to say. And when I stumbled upon her work, I nearly just fell over because it is both challenging and conventional. The woman looks like someone out of the 1950s. She toys a lot with gender roles in her work, a lot with race relations. And for it to be coming from South Africa, a contemporary voice there, I just felt like this is a way to have a global conversation and sort of do a global wink to how women live their lives across the globe. I also felt like the hands on the eyes were part of the way that we pretend as both black and white women that things are okay or that we can do this. We can have it all. We sort of buck it up and run in there and try to make it work with very little support systems institutionally. And I thought that it's interesting, you know, so many young people today will say, I'm not a feminist. I don't want to be a feminist. I don't like that. And to me, that's a way of walking through those with those blinders on, blind to what extraordinary pressure gender roles play on women and their ability to self-actualize. And I fully admit that they also play on men as well. I'm just writing from a women's perspective. But
yeah.
men are at the behest of all these roles, too, and it's really hard for them as well. But I thought that image was provocative enough for it not to be so deadly serious that you'd want to run away from the book as soon as possible. But also intriguing enough to say, like, how do we peel about? How do we take those blinders off, both as black and white women, as all women, and really, really kind of look at how all this plays in the most intimate moments of our lives?
And being a Detroit resident, I'm interested in your thoughts and perspective on Detroit today. I've heard that it, in part, is an emerging artist colony, which is interesting that a town that is known for the auto industry is now showing a little more art influence. I wonder if you're seeing that.
Yes. Yes, I'm seeing it. And I will have to say this. It has been that way a very long time. I think that places that are sort of do-it-yourself, nearly abandoned places where people have to navigate lives without a lot of structure or support, that is a creative experience, life experience, and art just blossoms from that. And Detroit has had the benefit of that for a super long time. I think what's happening now is the world is starting to shine a light on it. And not as sort of gut-level nativist response to the situations, but as a studied, I won't say academic response, but certainly a studied response, cultural response to what has been Detroit's history and what looks like will be its legacy. And so what I'm not necessarily talking about is people singing doo-wop on the street corner and saying Detroit has been creative in that way, even though it has. What I'm saying is that there have been movements. There have been art movements in Detroit. There have been artists that have come from fiberworks, from outdoor installations, from music, from all the stage, all of these, and they have gone to the world stage. And we, except for maybe music, have never quite been recognized for the real artistic beauty of that, and now people are seeing it. I recently, thank the heavens, became a Kresge Artist Fellow.
Mm-hmm.
the Kresge Foundation has been giving grants to individual artists for, I think it's been a little over 10 years now, as a way to help them take that art that they've been doing and take it to a national or even global level. And it's helped to shine a light on the amazing work, that's the amazing books, the amazing poets, the dance, you know, all kinds of things that are coming out of the city. And I'm so proud that I've been in Detroit long enough to see it when it wasn't that way, and now to see it emerging in a new way.